Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 17th of April 2016. My name is DRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Paul in London, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about 1972, The Future of Sex. This is a piece done by the Wardrobe Ensemble at the Shoreditch Town Hall. Wardrobe Ensemble, I think they did this production in Edinburgh, their Edinburgh smash hit, it should be said, and it's been garnered with quite a lot of awards. The Wardrobe Ensemble are an ensemble of storytellers, character makers and thought provokers, is what they say on their Facebook page. So I think we should believe them. John, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Sometimes when you're writing a review, the only thing you want to say is, trust me, you like this, go and see it. And I really do think people should go and see this. It's got quite a long residency at Shoreditch Town Hall, I think about 3.5 weeks. It speaks to you really, whatever stage of life you are, perhaps. But for me, enormously, because 1972, The Future of Sex, was the year I went to university. And it is so accurate. I was feeling the same sort of pangs that I probably felt at my first student disco. And that's where we are. We're in a Redbrick University in England in the early 70s. And this group of students and one lecturer, but let's say the students, are on the brink of their first big sexual experience. I think for anybody who is from a different generation, it's worth saying that in 1972, not only was everybody in your hall of residence also a virgin, nobody had seen any porn, because of course there was no online, and in order to go and see a dirty movie, as it was called in those days, you'd have had to join a cinema club or go to a very specific kind of cinema that only existed in Soho, perhaps. So those of us in the provinces, you know, not only were we pretty anxious about whether we'd get laid at our first student disco, we didn't really have very much of an idea about how. I think The Future of Sex captures this calculated risk perfectly. You know, so many productions set in this period opt for sardonic pastiche, but Wardrobe Ensemble embrace it wholeheartedly, you know, whether it's the loon pants and the tank tops, which they seem to wear with real conviction, to the kind of variety of hairstyle from a kind of balding Hendricks to a, you know, freshly ironed Janis Joplin. It's very authentic. The other thing the production has is incredible energy. It could exhaust you, even though it's only an hour, just, you know, observing these people literally charging about the stage and turning on a dime to both provide the characterization and the performances, but also the commentary. You know, people will snap from being in a scene to being the narrator. Very neatly done, really excellent ensemble work. They are a collective, they do work very collaboratively, but there's none of that kind of worthiness that sometimes goes with such a description. That they are really strong performers individually and collectively, and this production just sort of bursts over you with the enthusiasms and the tribulations of first love and first sex and new explorations of maybe something you haven't tried before, maybe something you're afraid to try. There's very little plot. There's little dramatic arc between the beginning and the end of the piece. There's a couple of central romantic engagements, which in other hands could be a bit of a cliche. You know, a girl has a crush on a young lecturer, which he then takes advantage of, or at any rate, they proceed to having some kind of relationship. A young girl has a crush on a woman, which she might not have done before, and how they get together and whether that works or whether it doesn't work is also central to the event. It's all punctuated with some predictable Bowie kind of rock music, but also some quite nice original stuff played by a guitarist in the background. And there are references, kind of reminded me of the end of the History Boys, where they project the future of each of those characters. And you can see that somebody maybe, you know, gave up a kind of fairly riotous student lifestyle to be a fairly dull accountant, or, you know, somebody had further misfortunes in later life. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but they do draw that parallel. There was a quote in The Guardian when it was up in Edinburgh saying that what seems like an entertaining romp full of spot-on period detail turns into something deeper and more poignant. I'm kind of My jury is a little bit out about that. I didn't read very much into it other than this excellent depiction of people on the brink of their sexual and intellectual lives. And I certainly didn't see any reference to Mary Wollstonecraft's 1792 A Vindication of the Rights of Women, which Lynn Gardner found, you know, she must have been reading it on the train. But
sorry, that's me snickering in the background.
That's all right. For anybody who lived through it, or perhaps if you have parents who went to university at that sort of time, I think it will be a really interesting outing, and it's great and directly engaging, and it's all there in your lap, and I really liked that. Paul, what did you think?
Well, actually, I think you may have hit the nail on the head about you've got raves in Edinburgh Fringe. What I think is that is the Edinburgh Fringe bias, where you're so desperate for something that's a really germ of an original idea. The minute you see something that's actually, you know, good or potentially to be a lot better, you give it 5-star reviews. But I think what's missing is it is style over substance. And, you know, there are a lot of theatrical tricks, the narration, the inner monologues, the jump cuts between then and the present day and so forth. But I think after a while, they become a bit tiresome and quite repetitive during this 1-hour piece. I think actually, if you see it as you described, as a sort of an expose of the period and just pointing out that, you know, things were just as awkward and odd as they were then as they are now, I think that's, you know, that's fine. But to actually draw any deeper meaning from this piece as it is at the moment, I think that's a bit of a long stretch. But having said that, as we get to the end, rather, you do get a sense of some very interesting stories that they could further develop. And I particularly liked, without giving it away too much, how they actually depicted sex, this big plunge, and they're all in swimming suits, and it's quite fun to actually see. And of course, the throbbing soundtrack that accompanies it throughout the whole piece gives it a bit of energy that otherwise you might not feel it has. But oh, yes, I was.
That has got huge energy all the way through.
I was bored with it, I have to say. It didn't. I spent most
of the time. You weren't reliving your early childhood.
Exactly. So I think if you were there, you might love it. Or if you're there now, maybe, if you're in that age bracket, it might have something to say to you.
To do a sequel, The Future of Sex 1973, that's the year I lost my virginity, so I definitely could contribute to it.
Yeah, you could help with the right then. But for me, it just didn't do anything for me. I wasn't that interested in it at all. And I think that part of it was that I just couldn't get involved in the characters.
We're now going to talk about Boy at the Almeida Theatre. This is a new play by Leo Butler, directed by Sasha Wares, and is inspired by Leo Butler seeing a teenage boy waiting at a bus stop and wondering what that boy's story is. And he's created this story of a boy wandering through the streets of London, essentially. This play is also designed by Miriam Bjerta, and Sasha Wares and Miriam Bjerta did a production of Game last year with a very innovative staging where the audience were all sort of hidden behind mirrored glass panels, so looking in on a flat while people were being shot. They've come back this time and taken Leo Butler's work and again done an extremely innovative and clever design. In fact, probably far too clever for the play, because I found it a little bit overwhelming. What we've basically got is a conveyor belt that rotates slowly around the stage. We are sitting on two sides of the stage and watching it constantly go round as people on the sides put various props on the stage and people come on and sit down. And that is one of the things that was most distracting initially, and I think one of the reasons they put people on stage as the audience was walking in was to get them over the shock of seeing people sit down without any visible means of support, which is quite a magic trick. And you do spend a good few minutes trying to work out exactly how they're doing it. To this day, I'm not exactly sure how they did it. It had something to do with little bolts on the floor where they could anchor their shoes, and people were wearing sort of fairly bulky shoes in some scenes, and it would allow them in some way to sit down, possibly because they've got some mechanism under their clothes and the people who did sit down tended to wear fairly concealing clothing. That kind of bothered me. But overall, this story is, as I say, about the 17-year-old youth. Really, we're spending a day with him, and we're seeing him navigate his way around a place that he finds confusing. He's lonely. You get the impression that he's only just left school, only a few months out of school, and not sure what he's supposed to do. He wants to get back with his friends, and they're not there anymore. They're off doing things on their own. He can't really communicate with people properly. He's fairly incoherent. He keeps speaking in street talk, which doesn't help him. He's fairly monosyllabic most of the time. And obviously the idea here is that we're getting, I don't want to say exactly a morality tale, but it is that kind of showing you how bad this boy's life is. I think a word that one of our contributors likes to say is poverty porn. And there is, a certain aspect of that, letting this boy's story tell you how bad the government are and how bad they're not looking after him. And there is a point to be made there, of course. But what I found, and I found most uncomfortable, was not so much his story, but what it was doing to me, because it was bringing out my inner Tory. It was making me say, well, why does he just listen? And this is the problem that I think this boy has. He just doesn't listen. He only ever seems to get the last few words that somebody says to him. And his life would be made twice as good if he just listened. And okay, that would make it go from terrible to marginally less terrible. But at least he would be able to build on that. But I couldn't get any sympathy for him, because anything that you would want to do for him would be presaged on him paying some attention to you. And he just doesn't. He never pays any attention. He doesn't listen. And he's sort of monosyllabic and extremely stupid. And your heart goes out to him because he's been left behind, and everything that the world has done, and he is lost in a confusing world. Well, you just think, yes, but if I were to help him, the first thing is he has to listen. And I found it so frustrating watching this, feeling that he was there to listen. Now, there is somebody, one of the people he encounters is the mother of one of his school friends, who clearly doesn't like him, and has obviously, as one of these sort of tough tiger single mothers, has made her son behave himself. And she will lecture this boy, saying, look, you've got to speak properly. Stop speaking street. You don't have to speak street. Speak properly. Listen to what I'm saying. She lectures him, and to a certain extent you just think, yes, she's right. I mean, her son, who we meet later, is not particularly happy at being put into some kind of unpaid training, which is just making him do work without really any reward or any particular future or training. But he's slightly better off than the boy who's completely drifting. And there's all kinds of reasons for it. It does appear that he's got a younger sister, but it's a stepsister. They share a mother, but they don't have the same fathers. The boy is played by Frankie Fox. And a lot of people in the reviews have talked about, the sensitivity of his performance. It is his stage debut. And he made me believe in this boy, but since I didn't like the boy particularly, it was difficult for me to sort of say how great his performance is. I had problems with this play about sympathising. I wanted to sympathise. I don't want kids to be left like this. I want them to sort of be able to build something out of their lives, but to a certain extent, there's a first step and he's got to make it. And I don't think, even though there is some kind of realisation right towards the end, he does have that kind of realization that he's going to have to change. There is somebody who talks to him and says something. I mean, it's that the final moment of the play, in fact, that you sort of say that the realization has come that he's going to have to build something. But I just didn't really care about him in the end. And it's a very well put together play. It's an incredibly clever staging, but I didn't like the play. It brought out my inner Tory, and I don't like having an inner Tory anyway. So what did you think about it, Gareth?
Well, I think this is about the biggest disagreement we've ever had on this podcast, and quite possibly we'll ever have again, because I'm a complete polar opposite to you on this play. What Leo Butler has done very effectively is he's presenting us with almost every social issue we're facing in Broken Britain here, albeit only touching upon some. And he's doing it through this boy, Liam, who is broke, he's lonely, he's got nowhere to go, he's got no purpose in life. And your argument that he won't listen, well, to listen, Tim, you have to have people to talk to. And the problem with Liam is that nobody is talking to him because his parents aren't at home. His friends have gone off and done other things. He's no longer at school. There's no social provision for him. There's nowhere to go. There are no youth clubs. There are no libraries. The whole problem is that our broken society is creating Liams by the dozen. And there are Liams all over London. There are Liams all over this country. And there are girls just the same as well. And all Leo Butler has done is tapped into this. And I think he's absolutely spot on that we have become a society whereby we allow this to happen. And I think it's an astonishingly, well, I mean, for 70 minutes, it really just packs a punch for me. It really covers a lot of ground. And I was welling up. I mean, totally to the contrary, I just felt for Liam and I lost myself in the characterization. I thought it was an extraordinary piece of writing. I think Frankie Fox's professional stage debut was also just as extraordinary as that. And then you have this staging where, you know, Miriam Boothor is clearly going through her travelator phase because she did a travelator for the trial at the Young Vic last year. But this is a more snake-like construction, much more complicated, much more clever. As you say, you know, I do agree with you that the people sitting down with no support is a bit distracting. But if you think Covent Garden silent statues, then you'll get the kind of drift of it, really. But John, I got over that fairly quickly. But I think the way it kind of moves you around London from one place to another and gives the whole play a sense of Liam navigating this city on his own in this day, lots and lots of other characters, obviously, he's encountering. But it's his story we're hearing. You know, and we're going to doctor's surgeries, we're going to offices of various government agencies, we're outside shops, we're outside nightclubs, we're at supermarket checkouts, we're at bus stops, we're in parks, the roadworks and bus shelters, and a whole load of front doors. I mean, it's just extraordinary. I mean, how else could you create so many different places? It's just a work of an incredible imagination from a direction and design point of view. And the night I saw it, I just left the theatre kind of, you know, I'd seen great theatre and I'd admired the performances and the staging, but I mean, it made me angry. It made me angry and it made me upset. And I just kind of wanted to rush down to Downing Street and get that more next door, his name escapes me, Osborne, and actually take them in and sit them in the front row to see what's being created, not just by them, but what's currently being presided over by them. So I think this is both urgent theatre, I think it's important theatre, and I would urge anyone to go and see this play.
I mean, you're right. It's just I couldn't get over it. As I said, his life would be made slightly better if he listened. And it's not that it would be made fantastic, it would be made slightly better. And it was just being frustrated that he's not communicating. And there are people who, not necessarily are trying to help him, but are trying to tell him things, and he's not paying attention. And you just think, I couldn't get past that enough. I mean, I saw all the same things you did, but I just couldn't get past that.
Now you're not listening to me. Tim, listen to me. When you and I were Liam's age, we had parents at home, we had careers advice at school, we had youth clubs we could go to, we had friends in the streets we played with, and it was a very different world. Liam's world, that doesn't happen. His parents are not. I mean, this is, you have to recognise, this is completely true. What's happening to Liam is true. It's what is happening in society. So, you know, I say you're out of touch, mate, because this is exactly what's happening all around you in this city. So I'm sorry, I totally disagree.
We're now going to talk about The Caretaker by Harold Pinter. This is Harold Pinter's 1960 play, and it is being performed at the Old Vic in a new production directed by Matthew Walkus. The cast of this play is Timothy Spall as Davis, the caretaker of the title. Daniel Mays as Aston, the man who's trying to do up a flat. And George Mackay as Mick, his slightly more together brother, who is a builder by trade. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Aston, the elder of the two brothers, has mental health issues, I think, as we say. But in this production also seems to have a bit of a physical handicap as well. I'm not sure I've seen that before. And he befriends this tramp who is being threatened by someone. So he kind of brings him back to this grubby attic room in the house that they're supposed to be renovating, and befriends him. And then his younger brother, Mick, arrives, and Aston isn't there when he arrives. So he doesn't know who Davis is, and in fact, it behaves in a very intimidating way for David with Davis. Mick seems to be sort of in charge of the house here, and he sort of delegates things like cleaning and whatever to his brother, Aston. And Davis is offered a job as a caretaker in the house. And then a while later, Mick also offers him the same job without knowing that Aston has offered him the job. Davis now starts to exploit their sort of hospitality and take advantage a bit of what they're trying to do. And in doing that, he kind of drives the brothers closer, because they're clearly not close. And by driving them closer, he kind of drives himself out, really. And as with all Pinter plays, it's not so much the literal that you're getting. You're getting the kind of atmosphere, and indeed, you know, you're left to decide what's really going on here. I mean, I have a sort of well-known aversion to Pinter, but I'm dragged back yet again to see a Pinter play, because I do very much like the work of Matthew Walkes. And the casting was for me to die for, with Timothy Spall as Davis and George Mackay as the more intimidating brother, Mick, and then Daniel Mays, who is a favourite of mine, if not anybody else's, as Aston. So I just thought the casting was fantastic. He's a great director. And what Matthew Walkes has done is the same as Jamie Lloyd had done, really, with The Hot House and The Homecoming, which I'd also been dragged to by the casting and the director and liked, is that he's not treating the play with the same reverence that people like Peter Hall have always treated Pinter's plays, and that allows them to take a kind of fresh look at the play. And I mean, I had the same sort of positive reaction to this as I had to the two Pinters that Jamie Lloyd's done in his season, really. It's got a brilliant, brilliant ramshackle claustrophobic design by Rob Howell. I mean, a really great space. And what they've done quite cleverly is they kind of pulled it forward from the stage, just not exactly into the auditorium, but sort of through the arch, as it were, which gives more intimacy to what is a vast theatre for a play like this with just three characters. I thought, I mean, Timothy Spall, I haven't seen on stage for such a long time, and I thought he was great. He clearly relishes the part. He's kind of at times had me thinking of Uncle Albert in Only Fools and Horses in his kind of meeker moments, but then he kind of becomes something more aggressive and manipulative as the play progresses. Daniel Mays is kind of cast against type, I think, really, because it's quite a restrained, very passive sort of character. And I thought it was good to see him doing that, really, and I thought he did that very well. And George Mackay really did intimidate me. I was sitting to the right-hand side at the front of the stalls, facing the stage, and in one of the most important scenes, his eyes were sort of, you know, pointing in my direction, and his eyes, it was the most incredible piercing eyes that were absolutely intimidating. And he also kind of struts around the stage in this tight leather jacket, looking very superior. So I thought all of the performances were really excellent. And another fresh look at Pinter that means I think I might be in danger of becoming a fan, really, which I would never have said that about 3 or 4 years ago. So a very, very good, very good production for me.
I've just worked out, I've seen The Caretaker four times now. We were talking about this before we began recording about which previous caretakers we've seen. And I think we both date back to Michael Gambon in 2000, then David Bradley in 2007-ish. And there was also a production of it at the Trafalgar Studios in 2010 with Jonathan Pryce. And you tend to name who played the caretaker in each case. Timothy Spall does seem to be very suited for this role, I thought. He really does it extremely well. I mean, he's much more articulate and sly than some of the other ones. I always thought that Michael Gambon was a bit loud and noisy and a bit of a drunk, really. And there's much more of a slyness and a subtlety to Timothy Spall's performance. I certainly agree about Daniel Mays. He's not an actor I really like, and I don't think I would have liked him if he had played Mick, which is what I expected him to play when I saw the casting. But as Aston, he does evoke a lot more sympathy and, you know, shows that he has a range. I've always thought he was a good actor. It's just I've never really liked him particularly. But I enjoyed his performance a lot in here, and I'm slowly starting to warm towards him. I thought this was a good production of the play. I don't know that it's quite the best, but I thought I'm a Pinter fan, so I enjoyed this a lot. But it's dangerous to compare different productions, especially when you can't remember them entirely. I thought it was overall a good production, very nice setting with the water coming down and everything. I mean, there is a thing about Pinter and his stage directions, and you have to obey them directly, and he's very particular about it. And it did feel that they'd captured the room, this upstairs attic room that they're in the setting, in the set that Rob Dahl designed it, extremely well, I thought. And it really did feel sort of run down edge, but also, you know, the way that the water leaking into the bucket, which is, you know, perhaps a little thing, but it just felt right. This is actually the first time I've seen Timothy Spall. He's one of the people I missed when I was first getting into going to the theatre regularly. The last thing he did was, I think, something at the Hampstead Theatre. And I'd gone to one thing at the Hampstead Theatre, and it was the thing on Next. I think it was Smelling a Rat. He was in that, and I had an opportunity to go and see it, and I just didn't in the end, and I always regretted that. So it's very good to see Timothy Spall in it, and he does seem to be really quite unnatural in this. And in fact, the odd thing was that although he's probably older than people like Donald Pleasance when he first played it, and older perhaps than some of the other people who've played it, he felt almost youthful for this. And it's an interesting idea that perhaps Harold Pinter, I don't know how old Davis is supposed to be, he's normally played in his 60s, but there was something almost youthful about Timothy Spall. So you think, well, maybe he could be played slightly younger, and that would be an interesting idea to see how that's done. But I find it a fascinating play, and this sort of pathological need that Davis has to constantly lie and constantly complain, even when people are helping him. You know, it's a fascinating study, and I think it is one of Harold Pinter's better plays, and I really enjoyed this production.
The thing I loved about the drips into the bucket was that every time the drip hit the water, as it were, the cast kind of looked up, and the audience also looked up, and it was a source of great hilarity, which is something I don't remember being funny from previous productions, which is perhaps part of Matthew Warchus's invention. And the other thing I'd say about Pinter, the precision of his stage directions, I went to a Q&A after, I think, the homecoming with Jamie Lloyd, and he said that isn't actually true, that Pinter is perfectly happy for people to play around with his plays, and Jamie Lloyd knew Pinter quite well. I mean, I don't think he wanted radical things, but that Pinter himself felt that people were too afraid to put their own stamp on things and to change things. And that this perception that you couldn't touch anything was more of a perception than it was a reality, which I think is quite interesting. Whereas with Beckett, it was written down and in his estate and guarded and all of that. Apparently that's not the case with Pinter.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.